Sir, I do thank you for allowing me to speak, but you must be mistaken as you introduce the other gentleman. My name is George Adam Mann, and it is so very good to be here with you today and speak with you. And you know, when he mentioned that some folks might be older than me, even I looked upon his countenance and I thought to myself, yea, verily. Of course, you do know, sir, that I was born in Lancaster, Pennsylvania in 1734. And you were how old then?
Yeah,
Five, six years old?
I was just a tadpole.
It is so very good to be here and to speak with you and to tell you a little bit about myself. And I would tell you some things about the founding of our country, tell you some things about religious liberty, and tell you some things about the freedoms that we all believe is ours, the freedoms of religion especially. Because you see, in the time of my grandfather, he lived in the Rhine Valley in what is called the Palatinate, the last vestige of the old Roman Empire. At that time, because of our religious beliefs, I don't know if you know the Rhine Valley, and I don't know if you know of our religious beliefs, and I will tell you more. There were several groups of people that had very strict religious beliefs that lived along the Rhine River, lived in the Rhine Valley, what you might call these days Germany. But during that time, unfortunately, there was a battle between the Germanic peoples and the peoples that lived in France, and that territory went back and forth and back and forth as they battled for that lush, lush valley. And whichever side would win, they did not care for people with strict and strong Christian beliefs to be living there. And they chased my grandfather, they chased my relatives, they chased all those who had those beliefs away. And by choice, no. By just the fact that we had no other choice, we traveled down the Rhine Valley and we tried to settle in France in an area that we would be allowed to stay and to worship as we believed, and we were not allowed to stay. And so we made our way across the channel and we went from France to Britain, trying to find a place to live where we could worship according to our beliefs, not according to a church state or a state church, but according to our personal beliefs that God was there and man was here, and that the only answer, the only bridge between those two was a relationship between God and man with no government interfering. And I do need to tell you that the English people, or should I say the crown, and the Church of England did not believe as we believed, and so we were given an opportunity, and I use that term very loosely, my friends, because the opportunity we were given was to leave. Now, we were given two choices when we were given the choices to leave. We could go to Ireland, and if you know anything about the British, you know that Ireland was considered a place where they sent those who were less than desirable, where they sent criminals, where they sent those who were cast-offs and castaways. And there was one other place that they could send us, but it was a long, long sea voyage. It was a voyage that some did not live through. And that was across the oceans to a colony that had been established that was called America. And my grandfather chose to come and settle in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You might know those types that were forced to settle in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We spoke the Germanic language, and for that reason, we were called not Dutch, but the German word Deutsch. And so you might know the term for those of us that lived in Pennsylvania that spoke Deutsch, that were from Deutschland. We were called the Pennsylvania Deutsch. And you might call us the Pennsylvania Dutch, but you and I know that we weren't Dutch at all. Now, I was born in 1734. Lancaster, Pennsylvania. My name, George Adam Mann. is not actually right. Because you see, our name was not M-A-N-N when we came to America. It was Americanized. It was Englishified, if you will, because our name was Mon, M-O-H-N. And my name wasn't really George. It was Georg when I was at home. And Georg Adam Mon became George Adam Man. Now, my wife's name is Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is just about 2 years younger than me. But I need to tell you a tale that you might not have heard and you might not believe as I speak with you and as I tell you my story. Because you see, early on, I had itchy feet. And I chose to leave Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I went to the Shenandoah Valley. And some of you may know the Shenandoah Valley. And we found land, and we claimed land, and we farmed that land. We plowed, and we worked, and we took care of that which is ours, and had strong and strict religious beliefs. But I will tell you, I had a son. When they started speaking of liberty, when they started speaking of freedom, when those rabble-rousers gathered in taverns, and we would not go into taverns, when they gathered in taverns and talked about rebellion, I urged my son to stay away. I urged my son not to get involved because it was not our way. We disdained fighting. We did not fight. We separated ourselves from society. We did not believe that it was our place to be involved in wars. And when the colonies declared war against the British crown, my son went to fight. And he got sick. Because you see, conditions were not what you might call sanitary on the battlefield. And he came home sick after fighting. I don't know if you realize there was no standing army in the Revolution. There was no draft. There was no person that came around and said, "You, sir, must serve. You, sir, and you, sir, must serve. Come with us." What would happen is men who could fight, who would walk away temporarily from their crops to leave their crops and their fields and their animals to their wives and to their children, they would go away for months at a time and they would fight with General Washington. They would fight with the Revolutionary Army. And then they would come home and tend their crops and tend their fields and be with their family. And they would go back and fight again, sometimes fighting for months, sometimes fighting for 6 months at a time. And my son got sick, and he came home to the Shenandoah Valley. And one day, as he was recovering, he stood in the doorway of our home with my wife and was talking about the battle for liberty, this truth that men are declared and chosen by God to be equal. We had neighbors that were British sympathizers. And a coward hid not too far from the door of our home and shot my son dead as he stood in the doorway of our home and talked with his mother. And his mother screamed and cried and called me from the field, and I came and I saw my son in the arms of my wife laying dead. And I chose to betray things that I held important, to stand for things that we held to be sacred and honorable. And unlike men who believed like I believed, unlike men of my particular faith, I chose to leave and to go and to fight. And I walked all the way back from the Shenandoah Valley. I walked back to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, mainly because I spoke German and I fought alongside men who were Germanic in heritage. And we fought in the Revolutionary War. After the war, I went home to the Shenandoah Valley. But I have to tell you, you know, the war was not over when it was over. Do you realize the British did not stay gone? They came back like a bad penny, they came back. And we fought more than once, and they were not done with us, because the colonies were this vast, vast territory with great, great riches. And that small island of Britain and its colonies there in Europe had nothing like what we are finding in America. And they were back again and again. And they came back with a vengeance. But I grew too old for that. I was given 500 acres in a land grant in Cynthiana, Kentucky. And I moved for the third time in my life from Lancaster, Pennsylvania to the Shenandoah Valley. And from the Shenandoah Valley, we left and we went to Kentucky. That bloody ground. And then, when I was 66 years old, my two youngest sons came to me and said, "Father, there is land available to be had just by claiming it across the river in Ohio. And we would go there and we would claim our land." And I said, "I think that's great. I'll go with you." And at 66 years old, my boys went first. And I have to tell you, they settled in a town that is now called New Burlington, once it's been settled. It's not too far from a town you may have heard of called Waynesville, along a river where two rivers come together. They staked a claim for several hundred acres. They were boys. They cut down mulberry trees and they leaned them against a central tree, and they made a teepee of sorts that they were staying in. And one night their horses left. And the older brother said, "I will go after the horses. You stay here," because they had cleared land down in the fork, down in the corner. They had a piece of bottom land that was beautiful, and they had cleared it, and they had corn growing there. And the older brother said, "I'll find the horses. I'm good at tracking. I'll go find the horses. You stay here and you tend our crop," because there was a man that had a hand crank mill in Waynesville. And when the corn is not only ripe, but when it's ready and hardened, take it there and have it ground into meal. And he said, the younger brother, "Yes, I will do so." The horses made their way back across the Ohio River, all the way to Cynthiana, from Maysville to Cynthiana. So from New Burlington, Ohio, in what is now Clinton County, what was Greene County at the time, to Maysville, to Cynthiana, on their own. And when winter came, my son chose to stay because I had told him, and my wife said, "We will go with you." Now here's the problem. The younger son had a corn crop, and Shawnee Braves came through along that river time after time after time. And one day he went down to check his crop and to see if there were any roasting ears that he could pull off and eat. And when he got there, he had to hide in the bushes because there was a half a dozen Shawnee warriors that had gathered around, and they had pulled armloads of roasting ears, corn before it's gotten hard, and they were roasting those over a fire, and they sat there and ate his crop. And we came, and we settled, and we lived. Now, I want to be me just for a little while, if I could, Roger, and tell you the rest of that story. George Adam Mann was my sixth great-grandfather. His grandfather, my eighth great-grandfather, born in the Rhine Valley, came from there to France and from France to England and from England to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, because of his beliefs that Jesus was the only intercessor between man and God. And George Adam Mann, now think about this, born in 1734, lived in 4 states, and the last state that he lived in was Ohio. Now, here's the fascinating thing, and I think you'll find this amazing. He was my 6th great-grandfather on my mother's side. My 8th great-grandfather is the one that left in Cape. The 6th great-grandfather on my mother's side, and I'm doing genealogy, and I find him, and I'm fascinated by his story, and somebody's written a book, so I was able to find all the, including the story of the Shawnee warriors. They did come, and they did steal the corn and ate the corn, and if you read Waynesville history, it's there. Now, New Burlington doesn't exist any longer. When they were making Caesars Creek Dam, they tore the whole town down thinking that the lake would cover all that area. It did not. I learned that he died in 1820, and his wife, Elizabeth, died not too long after that. And I got excited to find my ancestor fought in the Revolutionary War. But I have to tell you my disappointment when I found out that he was buried in New Burlington, because I thought 2 years ago, I thought that the cemetery was underwater. Now think about that with me, if you would. You think you found your 6th great-grandfather who was a Revolutionary War soldier, but he's underwater somewhere in Caesars Creek Lake. I was very disappointed. And then I found online, as I Googled, I found a picture of his gravestone. And I thought, oh great, somebody took a picture before they drowned his grave. And then I realized his grave was never underwater. His grave was actually several miles from the lake and still existed. And I was excited, and I have to tell you, I looked and I saw that it was, and listen to this, I live in Beaver Creek, Ohio. I saw that it was 16.5 miles from my home. Now think about this. I grew up in eastern Kentucky. I married a girl from Beaver Creek, and we lived in one place, and then we built a home in Beaver Creek. And my 6th great-grandfather is buried 16 and a half miles from where I live. And he died in 1820. Almost 200 years ago, he died. So I get on the phone, Roger, and I call my wife as I pick up my keys. I put my wallet in my pocket. I pick up my keys and I start to go out the door and get in my truck, and I'm talking to her and I say, guess what? My 6th great-grandfather, who I told you about, he fought in the Revolutionary War. He's buried 16 and a half miles from our home. And his wife is too. And she said words that changed my day. When she said, you're not going now, are you? And very quietly, I shut the door and I said, well, no. I'm not going now, because I was going now. She said, wait till I get home, and I want to go too, because she goes to graveyards of her ancestors and takes pictures and stuff while I sit in the car and read. And so I said, well, that's fine. You can go with me. And when we got there, she got off work at 5. We got there about 5:30, 5:40, and it was raining lightly. We had umbrellas and we had raincoats on, and we looked for the oldest part of that cemetery. And we walked up, and somebody, either a son or a grandson, had a monument that was probably 6 foot across that said M-A-N-N. And I knew I was close. And about 35 feet away, leaning backwards just a bit, covered with a little bit of moss, was the name George Adam Mann. And a metal star on a post right beside of it that said Revolutionary War Soldier. And I was thrilled. I was thrilled because I've been doing this particular program for years, but I told the story of the Revolution without understanding that we had skin in the game. And here's the thing you need to know. We all have skin in that game. You take a young man who was a school teacher, who was asked to be a spy. Did you know the British had taken over New York State, had taken over New York City? We probably wouldn't mind sometimes if they did today. But they had a stronghold. They had a bastion in New York. And they were looking for somebody who would go and would spy and would come back and tell General Washington the troops that were there and would tell him of troop movements and things that were going on and trying to find things out. And a young school teacher who had gone to college and had his school teaching diploma, a young man just in his early 20s. Stepped up when no one else would, and he said, I will go. And they said, you understand, if you are captured, you will be killed because it's treason to spy, because the British government considered every one of the colonists that were fighting against them to be treasonous. And a man, a young man named Nathan Hale, said, yes, I will go. Now, here's the fascinating thing. You talk about spy equipment. They had taken his shoe and they had taken out the insole and dug out the hollow of his heel so that he could write notes and fold them up and put them in and then put the insole back, which was just a piece of leather, I would imagine. He could then put it on and he could walk around. And at appointed times and places, he was to be able to take those notes to someone else who would take them to General Washington. But a cousin of his saw him making notes. A cousin of his saw him going around and looking and making secret notes that he put in his shoe and told the general who was in charge of the bastions there. And he was arrested and his shoe was taken. And they pulled that insole out and they looked and they found the notes that were obviously the notes of a spy. And he was charged and found guilty immediately and told he was to be hung the next morning. And as he was held, he asked for a minister to come and to talk with him and to pray with him. And the British soldiers denied it. He was asked if he could have a Bible so he could read and comfort himself. Perhaps with a 23rd Psalm that said, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And he was denied. He was held overnight and he asked simply for some paper and a quill to write to those that he loved, to his parents, to his friends, and he was denied. And the next morning he was taken out. He was not a big man. He was not a strong man. He was not a warrior or a soldier as he was taken out to the green, the central area, the square, and a rope was thrown over a tree, and he was asked if there was anything he would like to say, and perhaps they were hoping that he would declare his allegiance to the king. But he said those words that we will not forget when he said, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country, and he was placed on a box. And the rope was put around his neck and he was hung till he was dead. An act of treason by one government. An act of courage and patriotism by another. You know, the thing you need to understand about that war is that sacrifices were made not just by common people, but sacrifices were made by everybody who believed that life and liberty was a gift from God. When George Washington marched with his men like the Green Mountain Boys who came and fought, many of those men came barefoot. They did not have shoes. You have to remember the Revolutionary Army did not have supplies. There was one man, a soldier, who said it was easy to fight the British with their red coats because they could not hide. And that the Americans, the colonists, could hide easily because they were usually muddy and dirty and had dark rags on. In Valley Forge, when they fought, my friends, they fought barefooted. They say that when the men marched out of Valley Forge to fight, that you could follow the soldiers because of the bloody footprints in the snow as they marched. The shacks, the little bitty cabins that they built were thrown together with mud and sticks. without chimneys, and the smoke was so bad that many of them got sick and had pneumonia and died while they were waiting to fight. Things like dysentery just washed its way through the troops who would go home because they were so sick they could not fight. Did you know that in the midst of all that, George Washington had fought for the British? He was a colonel. They came and they asked him if he would command the troops, and he said no, and they begged him. They said, there is no one else, and he agreed. And at one point, there was no money, there was no food, there was no clothing, there was no shoes or boots to wear. Did you know that Martha Washington stayed at Valley Forge with the general and cooked for all the officers? Can you imagine a First Lady of the United States not only staying with the troops, but cooking for dozens and dozens of men? I can't. On either side of Congress, I can't imagine the wives cooking for anyone these days. The officers of the Revolutionary War were ready to leave. They were ready to quit. They had not been fed. Their men were hungry. Their men were dying. Their men were sick. And they were ready to leave. Congress sent a letter promising that as soon as they could, they would find a way to pay the troops. They would find a way to feed and to clothe the troops. And they asked General Washington to read it. And he stood before them. And as he stood before them, he was not a young man. And he felt in his pockets for his spectacles. And when he finally found them and took them out, he realized he could not read the letter without his reading glasses. And as he took them out, and he took a moment to clean them because it was a war. They weren't clean, of course. And as he was cleaning them, he stopped to ponder. And he got teary-eyed. And ashamed, he wiped the tears away as he put on his spectacles to read the letter promising to feed and to clothe and to pay the soldiers. And he said to the officers with tears in his eyes and a broken voice, he said, "Gentlemen, you will forgive me, for I have grown old in service to our country." And he paused and he turned and he wiped the tears away because they were not winning yet. And he read the letter and he walked out to let them speak and talk. And they chose to stay. And they chose to fight. Now here's the odd thing. Do you realize why they chose to stay? Not because of what Congress said, but because an old man who was growing older as he fought just stopped to say, "I'm weary. Stay with me." And because of his courage and his loyalty, they chose to do so. It wasn't just him. It was men like a lawyer. As much as we disdain lawyers, a lawyer knew that a doctor had been courageous and good and had cared for anyone that came hurt or sick. And that doctor was arrested by the British. They were back, 1814, summer, about this time of the year. They were back. A whole armada was there waiting. And the doctor had been arrested for being on our side. And he had been taken aboard the ships. And a couple men knew that there were people in the village that needed treatment and knew that the doctor had treated both Americans and British soldiers alike. And they had letters from the same, and they went out on a little sloop, which is just a little bitty boat with a sail. And they went out into that harbor and made their way and sailed and then rowed up close, believe it or not, up close to the flagship and asked if they could come aboard and speak to the admiral. what courage it would take a lawyer asking for a doctor to be freed. And they climbed aboard and they showed the letters saying, this doctor cares. This doctor does not take sides. This doctor cares for anyone and everyone that has a need. And we need him. And you need him. And the admiral agreed to release him, but said, we can't release you now because we are getting ready to bombard the fort. Anybody know what fort I'm talking about? Not Sumter, that's Civil War. Fort, what is it? Fort McHenry. You can't go yet. They were there and they were having tea when soldiers and officers and sailors were discussing the bombardment. And the admiral said, we will put you on another ship and hold you till after the battle because we expect to win. And they were put on another ship and the doctor was put there with them. And they stood and they watched as the British fleet began bombarding Fort McHenry. And they sent rockets. And rockets were new. And they sent bombs that would explode. And the bombs were hollow and they were full of pieces of metal. And the rockets would come. And because it was a new technology, they would explode sometimes before they got to their mark. And when they exploded, you could see things. Even in the dark, you could see the battle going on. And they threw thousands of rockets and bombs and cannonballs at the side of that fort. Now, here's the thing. The commander of that fort had had two flags made. A small storm flag that was not very big that should have gone up. But in defiance of that British fleet, he had not only put up, but he left up the big 30-foot by 40-foot or so flag, the biggest flag that he had. He put it up in defiance of them, and he left it up during the battle as hundreds and several thousand armaments came and hit. And a young lawyer stood with his friends and watched the battle all through the night. And in the morning, as dawn started to creep across the think about that. As dawn started to creep across the channels, across the bay, across the beaches, and up the sides of that fort, they stood there and they watched, because all night long they watched the battle, hoping that Fort McHenry had not surrendered. And when the rockets would explode, they would see that flag still up, not in surrender, because a white flag should have been there if they had surrendered. And in the dawn's light, and in that first light, that blue light you see before the sun comes up, he saw it again. And Francis Scott Key sat down and he got a pencil and a piece of paper and he wrote a poem. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's what? Last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous night o'er the ramparts we watched, and the ramparts were the top part of that fort, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare as it exploded and the bombs bursting in air gave proof through that night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? Now, his brother-in-law said, can I put that in a newspaper? And they did. And then they found a tavern song, not a drinking song, but a song that men would gather together and sing. And it was not an easy song. But the words to the poem fit the cadence of the song. And they sang it, and they sang it again and again and again, and we won. But as we come to the end of the program, I want to draw you back to the beginning and talk to you about 56 men from all walks of life. Some of them were lawyers. Some of them were ministers. Some of them were farmers. Some of them were merchants. All of them believed They were asked to write a declaration that would be sent across the oceans to the king, who was nearsighted, by the way. They put together a committee of three men, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Ben Franklin. Now, Ben Franklin was the oldest of the 56 men, and he probably was the wisest because he said, "Tom, I'll tell you what, why don't you take a stab at it? We'll see what you think, what we think." He didn't want to do it because it was going to be a lot of work. And there were 56 men that you had to please. John Adams, short little fella. Jefferson, tall and redheaded. And you know what that means. I have two nephews that are redheaded. You don't want to get them mad. They'll tell you what they think on Facebook. And they sat down. Now, here's the thing you need to know. Jefferson wanted to include the fact that slavery was contrary to God's laws. Did you know that? However, they knew that the southern states would not agree and would not sign if slavery was made against the law in the colonies. So it had to be stricken. And they argued and they discussed. Now think about this, this little room that they were in. They did not want to hear treason being discussed. They would gather together in the back rooms of taverns and in smoky rooms. They would gather together in this small hall there. The doors were shut, the windows were shut. The only windows that would be open were little bitty transom windows, not hardly as big as those vents. Let a little bit of air in, and I will tell you, did you know that most men who wore powdered wigs, horsehair wigs, wore them because of lice? They would shave their heads and keep their heads short because lice were so bad in the colonies. The problem is the lice didn't know much difference between human hair and horse hair. And so every time they would put their horsehair wigs on, they would itch because there was no good way. And the reason they powdered them was to try to kill the lice. They didn't want to look gray-headed. They just didn't want lice. And what I have on is not necessarily as cool as today's clothing, but it was much warmer for them because they wore linen, and they wore wool, and they wore cotton. And they did not take their coats off and their waistcoats as they discussed things. They dressed properly, much like this. Now think about those 56 men. As Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Benjamin Franklin worked on draft after draft after draft, and they put together in Congress the unanimous declaration of the United States of America. And it says those words that you and I know that say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, not declared by a government, to be self-evident. That all men, now think about that, it took us many, many years to get the all in all men. But that all men, and they use that term broadly, encompassing men and women, boys and girls, and Jefferson and Franklin and Adams meant exactly what that said, that all men are created. How? They are created. They did not evolve, they are created equal. Those words are words that change the world, my friend. They are words that perhaps we could lose. Did you know that after they voted, Benjamin Franklin came out and a woman came up to him and said, "Sir, what do we have?" Because they didn't know if they would have a democracy. They didn't know if they would have a monarchy. And he turned to her and he said, "A republic, if you can hold on to it." Words for today. A republic, if you can keep it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed, they are given by their Creator. certain inalienable rights. And if you read the writings of Thomas Paine, if you read the writings of Jefferson, of Washington, if you read the writings of our founding fathers, they proclaim again and again and again that Jesus is indeed the Christ. Now, they may be deists. They may not believe some of them exactly as we do. But there is no doubt that they believed that God was the foundation stone on which the United States of America should be built when they said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these, life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And all those things that they said the king was doing, that he was allowing soldiers to come and just stay in your house without your authorization, without your okie-dokie. All those things that they delineated there were contrary. It wasn't just about taxes, it was about freedom. The freedom to gather together as we are and to worship, because they weren't allowed to do that sometimes. My ancestors came here for one reason, because they could not worship as they chose. Now, you got to remember that July 4th wasn't when everybody signed. First vote was taken. There were men that had to go home and had to vote. 56 men. Some of them, they pledged their sacred honor. They pledged all that they were and all that they had, and some of them did lose life and liberty. They lost their families. They lost their wealth. But they pledged their sacred honor. And the moment they signed, now think about this with me, the moment they took up quill and they signed their name to that document, that moment they were traitors, just as Nathan Hale was a traitor. They were declared evil and wrong and contrary to the king and to the God of that king. They hid. They ran. And as they chose to write, John Hancock, who was president of that moment, he was in charge. He was the one facilitating the meeting. He got up and he took up the quill and he said this. He said, I know that the king is nearsighted. He can't see well. I'm going to sign my name so large that he will be able to see it across the ocean. And he signed what we today know as John Hancock. And that's why we say, put your John Hancock on there. But there's other men that wrote in small letters. There's one man that did not sign. He had to leave to get permission from his state. He never came back. Some of them had to come back. It wasn't completed until late August. But 56 men, knowing that their life was forfeit the moment they put their name on here, signed. Two men standing in line to sign looked at one another. One was large and heavy, and the other was old and thin, wiry, bony. And the fat one said to the thin one, my brother, when you and I are hung, you will die after me, because I am so big and fat that my neck will break immediately. And you are so small and so thin that you will hang in the hangman's noose and you will kick and you will dance and it will take you so long to die. And I will be in heaven before you. 56 men signed, knowing that they were making their lives forfeit. Now let me ask you a question. We're not young. Many of us could not fight if we wanted to. But if it were July 4th, 1776, male or female, would you sign on that day? If you knew your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren could die, that all that you had would be taken, that you would not have a home any longer. Benjamin Franklin was not a child. He was in his 70s when he signed. There were wealthy men, but there were poor men that signed that document. There were Christians that signed that document. There was one Catholic man. And you know what he did? When he signed his name right there, the only Catholic to sign it. He signed Charles Carroll of Carrollton. You know why? He said, so the king can come and find me. They were not Catholics and Baptists and Episcopalians and Lutherans on that day. They are, and we should be all, one thing, Americans. Because we hold those truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among those life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. So I ask you again, if you were there on that day, could you sign? Would you sign knowing that the moment you walked out that you were a traitor to the government and that your life was forfeit? You know what I've done a number of times now with this program? And I'd like to end it the same way. There's a table right out there. I'm going to go out there with this document and with a quill. And I'm going to ask you, if you were there, would you be brave enough, courageous enough? Would you be willing to give up all that you had to sign that declaration? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So, Roger, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to stand with this, and if you need to sit, you may want to go after several people, get in line and rest and work your way up. But would you sign? I'm going to leave this with you, Roger, when we're done.
Okay.
But would you sign? Would you say, all that I am believes in freedom? It's a hard question. Thank you.